Yes, Scotty and Brooks and Justin Rose dominate the talk here on Musings on Golf, but we also pay homage to the start of the 2026 Winter Olympics this week in Italy. And what better guest to tie together the Winter Games with the game of golf than Mike Ruzioni, whose goal with 10 minutes left in regulation proved to be the winner in the Miracle on Ice, as it became known, the U.S. victory over the Soviet Union in the semifinals of the 1980 U.S. Winter Olympics ice hockey tournament. You'll hear from Mike in just a couple of minutes, and you are hearing right now from Kelly Elbin, along with Jenna Self, our executive producer. Excited to have you here from Mike. Great interview. What a terrific individual he is, and you're absolutely going to love it. Before we get to that, what a dominating performance by Justin Rose, winning wire to wire at the Farmers Insurance Open, becoming the first to do so, the first since Tommy Bolt in 1955 to win wire to wire. He also broke a record, tournament record, that had been held by George Burns first, and then Tiger Woods, who matched it. And we'll hear later from Justin of just how much that was on his mind. Welcome back to Brooks Koepka and CBS Sports, ESPN, Golf Channel. They certainly showed enough of Brooks. And I guess we've seen sort of the new side of Brooks Koepka, much more welcoming Brooks Koepka. Patrick Reed is going to be following in the footsteps of Brooks, rejoining the PGA Tour later this year. Interesting, by the way, that LIV Golf is being played this week. Thomas Dietrich, who won the WM Phoenix Open that will be played this week, he won it last year, finished at 24 under par, won by 7 shots. Dietrich won't be defending. In fact, he will be teeing up more than 8,000 miles away as he has joined LIV Golf and playing in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, instead of in the desert in Phoenix on Thursday. So a lot going on. LIV Golf getting their official world golf rankings go ahead for the first time. So a lot going on in the world of golf. Mike Ruzioni has played in a lot of pro-ams and didn't really start playing until after his heroics at Lake Placid in 1980. And understandably so. He was just a college guy, basically, and became the toast of the country, along with his teammates that miraculously, truly miraculously won the gold medal at Lake Placid. Mike got invited to a lot of pro-am events, has played in a bunch of them, 10 handicap. He talks about his game and talks about his passion for golf, has his own tournament, his own foundation. They raise good money for his charity. And just so pleased that we're able to time this with the games. I don't know how you all feel. And Mike kind of touches on this a little bit. It's the last I'll say before we go to the interview. But we all do kind of remember where we were at moments. And mostly, you know, we remember where we were when September 11th happened or when the space shuttle blew up. But I can certainly tell you where I was. And I know a lot of you can remember when you were watching on tape delay. And I was just all of 19 years old, watching with my buddy TJ Nelligan and some of my other, soon-to-be fraternity brothers in Phi Delta Theta fraternity at the University of Richmond as the U.S. team took the ice that night. And there were certainly a lot of celebrations afterward in that little lodge for that fraternity in Richmond, Virginia, and throughout the country for what turned out to be, I think, is the greatest sports moment in the history of our country. And it brought together a nation that sorely needed it for lots of reasons at that time. And you'll hear Ruzioni talk about that and so much more right after you hear from our great corporate partners, Titleist, William & Harry, and the Friars Golf Club. Our friends at William & Harry are always looking for ways to stand out in the crowd. So for anyone who belongs to a country club, William & Harry can have your shoes private labeled to fit your specific needs. The same applies to your company or any organization you might be affiliated with. This makes you a clear winner. Why? Well, you have a better quality shoe that feels great, and you have the logo of your club, company, or organization on your shoes that really makes you stand out on the golf course. To learn more, visit williamandharry.com today and be sure to input our promotional code 15OFF, M-O-G, for a 15% discount at williamandharry.com.
Your most important shot is the one you're about to hit. And whether it's the first drive of the day, a difficult approach from a tight lie, or a bunker shot to save par, you need to know your golf ball will perform exactly the way you need it to. Superior performance on every type of shot. It's why the majority of the world's best players choose the Pro V1 or Pro V1X, and why you should too.
Is your golf life stuck in a bunker of country club hassles? Tired of the wait lists and the six-figure initiation fees? Well, at the Friars Golf Club, we take care of all of the hard work. Planning exclusive trips and unforgettable rounds on top-rated courses, so all you have to do is show up, have fun, and make lifelong friendships on the first tee, the 19th hole, and far beyond. Our terrific 2026 lineup includes international destinations like Dubai and Scandinavia, plus top domestic resorts such as Sand Valley and Black Desert, and access to some great private clubs. Join the Friars Golf Club today. Email us at info@thefriars.com, the word musings in the subject line, to receive a $500 trip credit when you join. We invite you to stop dreaming and start living the ultimate golf experience with the Friars Golf Club.
The puck is still loose. 11 seconds. You've got 10 seconds. The countdown going on right now. Morrow up to Schultz. 5 seconds left in the game. You believe in miracles? Yes! Unbelievable.
Well, nearly 46 years later, that classic call by the great Al Michaels still brings goosebumps, a lump in the throat, and an outpouring of patriotism not felt before or since for a United States sports team. And at the heart of it all was the captain, the kid from Winthrop, Mass., who scored the game-winning goal in that game of games against the Soviets and went on to win the gold medal in the 1980 Winter Olympics. We're just around the corner from a brand-new Olympic Games. He's here today to reminisce, look ahead to those games, and certainly to talk some golf. It is an absolute honor and thrill to welcome Michael Ruzzioni to Musings on Golf. Captain, how are you?
Hey, boss. How you doing? Good. Thanks for having me.
Mike, it's an absolute pleasure. Let's start with, I watched the Netflix documentary the other night, Mike. You and many of your teammates returned to Lake Placid last summer, I believe it was, for the terrific. It's so well done on so many fronts, Mike. Miracle, the boys of 80. Was that the first time that you and such a large group of guys had returned to the site of Olympic glory?
No, we go back every once in a while. We have a fantasy camp. I think this year is the 10th year of it. So a handful of us go back for the fantasy camp, maybe 8 to 10 guys. I get back there quite a bit, sometimes for speaking engagements. I also have a store on Main Street, so I go back to the store a couple times a year to do a kind of a meet and greet. But it's very rare that we all get together to go back there. And especially under that environment, you know, with the Netflix special, usually we're there for the fantasy camp. We're there for a couple of days with the campers and then we leave. This was, you know, sitting in the locker room, being interviewed, talking about it, walking down Main Street, you know, kind of experience it differently than we do at the fantasy camp.
The emotion seemed so genuine and so sweet in so many ways. And whether it was you guys sitting on the bench, as you said, walking the streets and having people yell to you and thank you. It must have been, even with all the accolades through the years, Mike, to be able to go back to that little village. And it's just a little place, right? It's just got to be so heartwarming and so special for you and the guys.
Yeah, because it's a special part of our life. I call it Pleasantville when you go to Lake Placid, because it hasn't changed. I mean, you see the oval where Eric Heiden skated. The stores are basically the same, the streets, the sidewalks, so they just did over. But, you know, you can go and watch the ski jumping area. You know, the museum that they have there is really nice. The rink is basically the same, other than they, you know, put new seats in and cleaned it up a little. But when you walk in there, you can be right back in what it felt like, you know, 40 something years ago. And it's surprising. I think the older you get, the smaller the rink gets.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
Again, it's hard to believe they held an Olympic Games there. Yeah. And I remember Al Michaels talking about the sound in the arena when we were playing. He said the booth where they were doing the game, broadcasting the game, was like shaking. It was so loud in there. And, you know, as a player, you don't really hear a lot of the noise because you're so focused on being on the ice and playing. But I can just can't fathom, you know, how crazy it must have been in that building, how loud it must have been.
Mike, in that documentary, Jim Craig says that it was a once-in-a-lifetime event that cannot be duplicated. And I would imagine you would share that. And I would think for the millions of Americans who watched it, it's the same feeling. It was a confluence, Mike. I mean, the country was really in a bad spot. And what you guys did over those games was simply, it was uplifting in so many ways.
You know, I've been saying we could use a 1980 now, you know, at the time where we need people to come together. And, I think what separates the event, too, it's, and I've said this many, many times over the years, other than being a police officer, a firefighter, or somebody in the military who serves our country and protects us, there's no greater feeling than putting a USA jersey on. Yeah. You're not playing for Chicago or Boston or San Diego. You're playing for your country. You're not playing for a Super Bowl or a World Series or a Stanley Cup. You're playing for the dream of winning an Olympic gold medal. And I think the crowd and the people felt that. They felt a part of it. People come up to me today, to this day, depending on how old they are. I remember where I was when Kennedy was assassinated. I remember where I was when the Challenger blew up. I remember where I was on 9/11. And I remember where I was when we won. And I always go, we... I didn't know you were on the team, but that was that moment. And I think, you know, we'll never have that again. The pros versus the you know, pro Russian players versus the amateur players, the college players. Our average age was 22 years old. So there was a lot of things that went into it that made the event bigger than a hockey game.
And you know what was interesting, Mike, in the up to the second society we live in today, where everything happens so quickly. It's so funny to think that that game was on tape delay.
Yeah.
At ABC Sports, right? With the great Jim McKay calling, the, you know, anchoring and kicking it over to Al and Ken Dryden, it wasn't shown live. Right? Yeah. Maybe that adds even more to the aura of that game.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, there were only three TV stations there, and most people that I talked to watching it with the, on a black and white TV with the, aluminum foil on their antennas, you know, it was, I think, which made the whole thing that much more exciting and interesting. And, you know, we talk about the Soviet game all the time. That's the game everybody talks about. But
yeah,
if we don't beat Finland on Sunday, you and I aren't having this conversation today.
Correct. Right. Well, also, if who scored, Baker scored the goalie, 20 seconds left in the very first game against the Swedes. Now, if he doesn't get that goal and you guys lose that game 2-1, could you with the win over the Soviet, could you still have gotten to the medal round?
Yeah, I think we could have, because we beat Czechoslovakia. Uh-huh. If we had tied another game, we were gone. But the fact that we got the 1 point against Sweden, and then we beat the Czechs to finish second, we actually finished second in our bracket because Sweden had a better goals for and goals against. So then the crossover game was the number two seed, which is us, has to play the number one on the other side, which was the Soviet. So Billy's goal was huge, just to get us to the medal round. That was, you know, that's the goal of our team, was, you know, let's get to the medal round and see what happens. And, you know, the two countries that they didn't think we could beat, or maybe even three, maybe they thought West Germany could beat us. And West Germany was beating us by a score of 2-0, and we came back and won that one. But the first two games were huge.
So pleased to be joined by Mike Ruzzioni. Mike, this is a golf show, so we're going to kind of bounce a little bit between golf and hockey. You were nice enough to respond to my text the other day to let me know you have an index of 10.0. You play about 50 rounds a year of golf. Although, what did you say about your wife? How many rounds do you think she thinks you play?
She's in the other room. I think she says I play about 100. Do I play 50 rounds of golf a year? We're not talking right now.
Yeah.
She thinks it takes 6 hours to play.
Well, it can. Based on what you do before and after, it can, right? You mentioned that you didn't start playing golf until after the Olympics. I have to imagine, Mike, that a lot of pro-am opportunities that you took advantage of came quickly after the games at Lake Placid.
Yeah, I caddied as a kid. The golf course is literally out my back door. It's a little 9-hole course. About 100 yards. It's called Winthrop Golf Club, but we call it, it's a bar with a golf course attached to it.
Right.
And I caddied as a kid there, you know, $2, $3, but I didn't have any money to take up golf or play golf. Yeah. And then after the Olympics, my hometown gave me an honorary membership to the golf club and a set of golf clubs. And I took up golf. And then I started to get invited. I'm going to tell you, I think I can tell this story. I didn't know anything about golf or things, but the first event I ever got invited to was the Nabisco Dyna Shore in Palm Springs. And I flew out with Bobby Orr on a Nabisco jet. I'd never been to California. I'd never been to Palm Springs. This was only a few weeks after the Olympic Games. And I get up on the first tee, and they announce me, and the place goes crazy. And I got my baseball swing, or I didn't have a golf grip then. And actually hit a pretty good drive. And I was playing with a girl named Kathy Reynolds.
Sure.
And she was just a good player and a beautiful, beautiful lady. And I'm cool. I'm in California. I've never been anywhere. I'm playing with Rod Gilbert. Oh, yeah. He was the other celebrity in the group.
Yeah.
And we tee off, and Kathy gets ready to hit the ball. And I look at her caddy, and I said, oh, my God. I said, I can look at that butt all day. He says, you. I married her. It was her husband. Rod Gilbert was on his back on the tee laughing. I felt about this big. And it was, okay, Mike, welcome. You're not in the locker room anymore. This right. is a whole different environment. And then the next day, I played with Barbara Moxness. She was out of Buffalo. And I said to her caddy, I said, are you guys married? He goes, yes, we've been married for a few months. I said, let me tell you what I did yesterday. And I got to play in a bunch of Dyna Shores. I played in the Hope a couple of times. I actually won it one year with Roger Clemens. It was me, Roger Clemens, and Matthew McConaughey. We were the three celebs in the group, and we won the Hope that one year. That was obviously a long time ago.
You and I share a friend in John Miller, who put together the American Century Championship.
Yeah,
Mike, that's become so successful. I think you played in the first 25 of them, roughly.
Probably the first 25. Now, you know, I just don't play that well anymore. And if I went up there now, I'd be the oldest player on the event. But boy. It again, it's funny bringing up, because I was talking to John Elway the other day, because I saw the John's Netflix special, which was really, really good. And I called John, and, you know, we reminisced a little bit about going out, because one year we went from his event to Tahoe and we took John's plane, and we were laughing about that and talking about that. But, you know, Danny Marino played and Elway played and Mario Lemieux played, and Mario actually won it one year. And over the years, they, you know, early years, you know, Danny had his tournament in Florida. Mario has his in Pittsburgh, and he still has it. We still do an event with Mario. John has had his in Denver. I now have one here in Boston for my charity. But over the years, a lot of athletes had their own fundraiser. Mark Rippon has one in Baltimore that I've played in. Dan Jansen has one in Charlotte. Ken Singleton, you know, there's one almost every week you can play somewhere. And have a great event and raise money for charity. And that's the fun part about, for me, was taking up the game and getting to go to so many courses and raising money for my friends and their foundations.
Mike, I was director of communications for the PGA of America for a dozen years. And the charitable component of golf was something that the PGA of America and certainly the PGA Tour stresses. And as you said, to be able to, it maybe is unique about golf, Mike Ruzzioni, in that you're going out there and playing, but the money that's raised to help all these different people in need, whatever it may be, it's kind of what sets the game, to me, apart from the others.
No question. And that's part of the reason you go and play in them. You know, Mario comes to my event and plays in my event. I go to make sure I go to his event. And to see the guys. We have a lot of fun, and we've met so many great people over the years. But the bottom line is giving back. As athletes, we've been fortunate and blessed to do the things we've been able to do. And, you know, shame on us if we don't do things like that and play in the charity events. And it's competitive, you know.
Yeah, sure.
You guys, especially you go in Tahoe, boy, they compete against each other pretty well. There's some really good players that play as well. So And then just, you know, so much fun that we have and getting to see each other, you know, see Jimmy Matt McMahon out there barefoot having a blast and people following, you know, but some years more people are following Charles Barkley than they're following the leaders of the tournament. So that's what's fun about golf and why I just love playing it.
Let's talk about hockey and golf and the obvious parallels of the movement of the hockey shot as opposed to the golf swing. You mentioned Mario Lemieux. Joe Pavelski won the American Century last year. You've got the likes of Brett Hull, Mike Modano. I mean, really outstanding hockey players who are terrific golfers. Is it just as simple as the motions between firing a slap shot and hitting a golf ball, Mike? Are that similar?
I think it's similar. I think it's similar to feel and touch. You know, you got to have soft, you know, not that I had soft hands, but a guy like Mario and some of these guys, their hands are incredible. You know, the feel for the puck, the feel for a lob shot, a feel for something like that. Plus, I always tell people, hockey players have the summer off. You know, so they're playing. You know, baseball guys are playing baseball. Football guys are probably training a lot of that. And, you know, football players are usually a little bigger. I found the better football players are the field goal kickers, the quarterbacks, the wide receivers, not a ton of offensive linemen, you know, but because they're so big. And then, you know, I mean, and Steph Curry's a really good player. There's some good basketball players, and sometimes the basketball player is just too big, too tall. So it's a little harder for them. But I think the sport of golf and the sport of hockey, compared to all the sports, is probably more similar.
In addition to the information you sent me about your index and number of rounds of golf, Mike Arizioni, 7 holes in one.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
7. Okay, where was the first one? And Mike, I've played golf a long, long time. I still haven't made a hole in one. You've had 7. Okay, where was the first one? And what was the most recent one?
The first one is an absolutely amazing, amazing story. I had a speaking engagement in Colorado. And my wife came with me at the time, and she was pregnant with my son after having a daughter. And I said, why don't you come? It was for Frito-Lay, Roll Gold Pretzel Frito-Lay. So I'm out in a Telluride. It was in Telluride. Yeah. And I got a call from my sister that my wife's dad passed away at 52 years old. And I had to tell the people I had to leave right after I spoke. So I flew home, and my partner and I were in this big Calcutta, our big money tournament. And they let us tee off later in the day after the services. And I said, and my wife was one of 13 kids. And I remember going up to them saying, look at you, the sign that your father's still here says, I'm going to get a hole in one today. And on the 6th hole at my little 9-hole golf course, I knocked it in the jar. And I remember holding the club up in the air and going, oh my God, he's watching over me. And word quickly spread to my wife and the kids. And we got down the 9th hole, then the next time around the 18th hole, her and her sisters and everybody, the family was there to meet me. And my partner and I won the tournament. I think we won $6,000 or $7,000 and gave the money to my wife to help pay for some of the funeral. So that was the first. And the last one I got was at Hilton Head, the Ocean Course, the par 3. I don't know if it's the 4th hole or 6th hole. And I knocked it in the jar. I think I hit an 8-iron. I've had 4 8-irons. But it's been a few years since I've had one. But if you play enough golf, you're going to get them sooner or later. But we had some fun stories with some of them. I got one with Tom Dreesen and Dan Jansen at a celebrity tournament in Chicago. That was always fun because that's special because I had just gotten to the tee. I didn't hit a ball. I went right to the tee, took a 9-9 out, knocked it in the jar. And DJ looks at me and says, you didn't even take a practice swing. I said, I know, and it went right in the hole. I said, what a day I'm going to have today. So like everybody, everyone's got some great golf stories, but those are some of my favorite ones.
Fantastic. You know, the tradition, obviously, Mike, is when you make the hole-in-one, for some strange reason, you pay for the drinks for everybody. Somebody asked me to ask you, Mike Arizioni, when was the last time you paid for a drink, or at least in the years that immediately followed 1980, you couldn't have paid for too many drinks, Mike.
No, I had a really good run for a while, drinks and dinners. But it's caught up to me in the last 10 years because I think people see that financially things are good for me now. So I'm usually buying and paying for things. But I've also benefited quite a bit.
Yes, you did. Absolutely. And deservedly so. He's the author, along with Neil Baudet, who helped you write the national bestseller, The Making of a Miracle, The Untold Story of the Captain of the Gold Medal Winning 1980 U.S. Olympic Hockey Team. It's published by HarperCollins. Mike, that was that sort of an anniversary? Because you wrote that just a few years ago. Was that sort of an anniversary of the 1980 team where you felt like, I need to get this on paper?
No, it was really strange. Neil Baudet called me, and he's a Boston University guy, and he said, I'd like to write a book about the 80 Olympic team. That, what do you think? And I said, let me ask the guys. So I asked the guys on the team, and they weren't interested, which didn't surprise me because my teammates, we don't seek anything, any attention. It just happens. Yeah. Nobody wanted to write a book and tell their story. So I said, Neil, nobody wants to do it. He goes, well, what about you? And I went, I don't know. If you got to write a book, you got to go to book signings, you got to travel. I said, I don't need to tell people about my life. And then I thought about it, and I talked to my wife about it, and she said, yeah, well, you should maybe do that. And then I thought more, and I thought, you know what? I want to write the book, and I wrote it for one reason, and I say it in the book. I want my grandkids to know that Papa's life wasn't one game, one goal, one moment. I want my grandkids to know about their great-grandfather, their great-grandmother, my family. I come from a very tight, close-knit Italian family with a lot of cousins, a lot of aunts and uncles in the house I grew up in. And that was basically the reason behind the book. And it talks about how I grew up, the life I grew up with. I lived literally two houses from the house I grew up in. My wife grew up four houses from me. My son lives directly behind me. My daughter lives down the street. It's kind of crazy. But that's how we lived. And I wanted them to hear my story and get a better understanding of how I lived my life.
Could you elaborate a little bit? I saw it on the Netflix documentary. You mentioned about the aunts and uncles and family. The home where you lived, Mike, like a three-tiered home. Could you just tell a little bit again of how many people lived there and so forth?
Well, it was a three-family house. And my uncle Tony was kind of the breadwinner of all of the family. He had a very successful job. My dad worked three jobs. My mother stayed home and took care of six kids. My uncle downstairs worked two jobs. But Uncle Tony was kind of a good businessman. And what happened was we lived on the second floor, and upstairs was my Uncle Tony, who was my mother's brother. And then my mother's brother married my father's sister.
Okay.
Okay, and they lived on the third floor. On the first floor was my father's other sister, and they were twins. So when my mother was pregnant, my aunts were pregnant. So there was 14 kids that grew up in the house I grew up in. And we played sports 24 hours a day. There was a little yard next to the house we grew up in, which now my cousin built a house in, and he lives there.
Right.
It's kind of crazy. And then, that was kind of how we lived our life. And it was very simple. It was a working-class environment. And I talk about it in the HBO documentary. I was 12 years old, and there was a hockey school in Lynn, Massachusetts, about 20 minutes from where I live. And it was $75 to go to the hockey school, but my parents couldn't afford $75. So I went upstairs and asked my Uncle Tony if he'd lend me the money. And he did. And we had a couple of snowstorms that winter. And I went out and I shoveled and I made all that money back. And I went upstairs one day and gave Uncle Tony the $75. I said, thank you very much. And he gave me the money back. And he said, you learned a valuable lesson about paying your debts. And I talk about that in the documentary. So that was in that house. That was the kind of house we lived in. The respect and values were important. My dad always said, be a good person, be a good neighbor, be a good friend. Values that I carry to this day, things I tell my kids. I don't care how many goals you get or touchdowns you get. Be a good person. In my case, be a good father, a good husband, a good neighbor, a good grandfather. Those are things that are far more important. And I even tell my own kids, just because I scored the winning goal against the Soviets doesn't make me any better than anybody else. I was very happy with my life before. Clearly, 1980 changed my life. It's given me opportunities to do things I wouldn't have dreamed about. But it shouldn't change you. It shouldn't change who you are. I guess that's another thing that drives my wife crazy. I'm the same person I was, when I was in high school. Why change because of an athletic achievement? But yet it's benefited, and I've benefited, and my kids and my grandkids have benefited a great deal because of what happened to me in 1980.
Living those roots, that foundation is why you've stayed the same, right, Mike?
Yeah. How do you, you know, life changed. I was very happy with who I was. And clearly, like I said, the things that I do and, you know, financially, things are great. You know, I own a house quite a few years ago. I don't know if you know this. I sold almost all my memorabilia. I still have my skates. I have the stick from the Finland game. I have my gold medal. And I have the rings that we were going to get. And I'm probably going to sell the gold medal. I'm going to sell the, I won't sell the rings, but I'll sell the stick and the skates. But years ago, I got $1.7 million for all my equipment. And I took the money and I endowed a scholarship in my mother and father's name at Boston University. I put money into my own charitable foundation that I started years ago, hence my golf tournament that I have to raise money. And the rest of the money my three kids took and bought houses. So, right. You know, and now the medal for me, it sits in a safety deposit box in the bank. And what am I going to do with the medal? If I can sell it for, which I think I was told can get decent money, I take that money and I'll give it to my grandkids and start their scholarship funds and start their life. You know, you can't wear it anywhere. You know, the grandkids do take it to show and tell once in a while for school, but it sits in a safety deposit box in the bank. So if I can do something with that for my grandkids, then their future, that's far more important than what the medal is. I know what the medal stands for, but it's never going to take away the memory or the feeling of what it was like to be on that team and be with my teammates.
We are near the end of our time with Michael Ruzzioni, the great gold scorer for the United States in the, what it was, you're right, it was the semifinal game. And I think people lose track of that you still had to beat the Finns, right? And in fact, you guys trailed going to the third period. And Kenny Morrow said in that documentary that it was as complete a period as you guys played, right? Did you guys have that feeling coming out of the locker like, for Christ's sake, let's just get this done?
If you could have heard how many guys in the locker room after the second period were saying, there's no way a bunch of Finns are keeping us from a gold medal. Jack O'Callaghan was walking around the room, talking about it. And I think, and Kenny's right, I think the best 20 minutes of hockey we played all year were the final 20 minutes against Finland. And I'm sure there were some hockey fans listening, but I didn't know this until about maybe a year ago. Robbie McClanahan told me in the third period of the Olympic Games, in the third period, we outscored our opponent 16-3. That is a ridiculous, crazy, crazy number. So all the skating, all the drills that we did, we wore teams down in the third period. As a matter of fact, in the Soviet game, I scored with 10 minutes left to go. They only had 5 or 6 shots on goal in the last 10 minutes. In the Finland game, they didn't even get the puck out of the zone. And again, that, you know, that tribute to Herb and what he put us through for that whole year. But we were clearly a good hockey team. You know, I always tell people we didn't suck. It's not like we couldn't play. We were young, but we had incredible speed and conditioning. And yes, we bowled four lines. You know, we played four lines. Sometimes we'd play four lines in a minute and 30 seconds. You might be out there 15 seconds and you're off the ice. And I've always said this, if it wasn't for Mark Johnson, we don't win. Well, Magic scored all the big goals when we needed him. He kind of got lost in the shuffle because he's fairly quiet, although he's the winningest college hockey coach in women's hockey. And I think he's won about 4 national championships in a row at Wisconsin, and they're favored to win another one. But I think, you know, our team, we understood what we needed to do in order to win. And when it came time to put everything together, we showed how good we were.
Mike, a couple of hockey questions and then a golf question, and I'll let you go. First on the hockey, Coach Brooks was a complicated guy and obviously a very demanding coach, and it ultimately worked out. I'm wondering, after you guys won the gold medal, did you ever spend any time with Herb before he passed away and talk about what you guys had gone through, what he had put you through, and why it all worked out?
A little bit about it, because he still stayed away. You know, distant. Although when he was coaching the Rangers, I was the broadcaster for the Rangers. So I would see him before games and we would talk a little. But I always tell the funny story. Here I am at home and the phone, this was before cell phones, and the phone would ring and my wife would answer the phone and she'd go, "It's Herb." And here I am, 3 kids at home, and I'm worried about, is he going to yell at me? Did I do something wrong? And he still had that aura about him. He coached that team the way he felt he needed to coach us. And I've said this before, and I've done a bunch of interviews lately. I don't know if I said it to you, but 2 things about a coach. If you don't trust your coach and if you don't respect your coach, you're in trouble. Yeah. We trusted Herb. We respected Herb. He was running the show. if this is the way it's going to be, then this is the way it's going to be. I'm not going to quit. You can yell at me all you want. You know, after practice is over, I'm going to go have a few beers with the guys and we'll come back to practice the next day. But he did exactly what he needed to do in order for us to win. And he always said there's a method to my madness. And there was. But guess what? The results were the results.
Is there some similarities? Are there similarities between Bill Belichick's approach, certainly with the Patriots, to what Herb did in that condensed period of time with you guys?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, from what I've read and heard about Bill, you know, he kind of kept his distance to a degree, but he was in charge. This is the way it's going to be. It's sad to say this, but it's hard to do that today. And I help out with our high school hockey team. I've been helping out since 1980, and I'm in the locker room with the 14-year-old, 15-year-old kids. I watch my grandkids play. I see what goes on. It's not easy being a kid today. I wouldn't want to be a kid today. I lived in a very simple world with between the Facebook and the TV and the phones and everything now. And coaching is very different, too. I think Herb could coach today, but he would probably change his tactics a little. You have to be, you know, you can't yell at Johnny and Susan anymore. You got to be careful how you approach that issue. In the old days, no, this is the way it's going to be. If Herb yelled at me and I told my dad would yell at me because Herb yelled at me. You know, or in school, if I went home and I said that I did, the teacher said I did this wrong, then I was in trouble because the teacher was right. And I'm not saying everything's right as well, but the era of today is very different than it was then. And I think coaches today have to coach a little differently.
I don't think there's any question about it. Mike, final hockey question. I thought Kurt Russell was terrific in the movie Miracle. But that's me speaking. From your standpoint, what did you think of the movie? And what did you think of Russell's portrayal of Coach Brooks?
Kurt was absolutely amazing. Amazing. I remember when we watched the movie as a team, Herb had passed away. And I was sitting in the theater with Herb's wife, Patty, his son, Danny, and his daughter, Kelly. And as soon as Kurt came on the scene for the first time, Patty went, "Oh my God, it's him." Huh. I mean, it was scary. Although a little friendlier in the movie, a little softer in the movie. He smiled in the movie and we kind of went, who's that guy? But Kurt was brilliant as Herb. And we liked the movie. It's a little Hollywood here and there. I like the documentary maybe a little better because it's us telling our story. And you hear some great stories in the documentary, but I thought the movie was done well. If you saw all the kids that come up to me that you saw the mail, the letters I get in the mail to this day, you know, I probably get 100 a month from people wanting autographed pictures and kids saying I watched the movie Miracle. Requests I get from teams that are playing for a championship game. Hey, Mike, can you talk to the locker room? We're going to show movie. We're going to show Miracle. Football teams, basketball teams, soccer teams, you name it. I've gotten phone calls from coaches. We're going to see Miracle right before the game. Can you come on after and wish him luck. And I don't think my record's very good because a lot of these teams have lost after I spoke to them. But it's a great movie, and it's a fun movie. It's a happy movie.
Two final questions. One, you mentioned about your golf tournament. I believe you have that each year, and also what it supports. Can you tell a little bit about your tournament, Mike, and your foundation?
Well, at my tournament, it's a group of people called Cool Kids Campaign. They're out of Baltimore. I had my own tournament for years, and I tied it in with Cool Kids, and then Cool Kids Dads with kids with cancer, families with cancer. Dan Jansen has one. It's for Cool Kids. Kenny Singleton one. It's for Cool Kids. I split mine, so does Dan, with his foundation and Cool Kids. Mine is with my foundation and Cool Kids. I started my foundation years ago. I was on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, and I got $150,000, and I thought, well, let me start a charitable foundation. I started in memory of my mother and father. And we basically keep it in the community, although I have donated money to various charities across the country. I always donate to Mario's event. I always donate to Dan's event. And it's a great little tournament at Tedesco Country Club in Marblehead, Mass. Usually get about 22 or 23 four fivesomes. Local celebrities, you know, play Ray Bourque, a lot of Bruins. Mario Lemieux plays. Jim McMahon has played. The late Clark Gillies used to come all the time because Clarky still has his tournament in New York. So it's a fun event. We raise, you know, decent amount of money, and the money goes to, like I said, to my community. You know, if we find a kid, a boy, a girl that can't afford to play sports, we'll donate and help them do that as long as their grades are good in school. And it's nice to be Santa Claus. We buy family presents at Christmas for families. We buy meals for Thanksgiving for families who can't afford food. So it's very enjoyable. My wife and I, my brothers and sisters are a part of it. So it's a fun event. And like I said, we do something great with the money.
You mentioned your parents a couple times, and in watching the documentary on Netflix, they showed a couple of times where guys sitting there at their current age and would watch the clip, and they would show their parents. And they got very emotional, right? Understandably so, because that was when their parents were back in their prime and so proud. I'm wondering if how often you think of your parents. You mentioned about the lovely story about your uncle and the $75 and that whole familial, the family component of, and particularly as it for that, yeah, that short period of time in Lake Placid.
I think of them all the time, because if I go out on my back deck right now and I take a look to my left, that's the house I grew up in. And I can still see my mother on the porch with the clothesline, putting the clothes out, and my uncle on the third floor, my aunt on the first floor, and us playing in the backyard. And they would stand on the porch and lean over the railings and watch us play hockey or baseball or basketball in the backyard. And then, you know, yelling at you to come in because food was on the table. Or like I said earlier, if I didn't like what my mother was cooking, I'd go upstairs and eat, and I'd sit at the table. I'll go downstairs and eat breakfast because I was tired of eating what my mother was making. So when
you had options, right?
Yeah. When you grow up in that environment, you know what? I always tell people life's about opportunities. Yeah. And my parents gave me an opportunity to play a game, never knowing, dreaming or believing it would get to where it got to, but it did. You know, my mother saving money, you know, 50 cents to skate on Sunday mornings and borrowing 50 cents or sneaking and taking 50 cents out of my dad's tip bar from the night before when he was waitering. To pay for hockey. So you think of things like that. And if it wasn't for them, I wouldn't be in. And my teammates had the same kind of stories. I mean, Kenny Morrow talks about his dad, and it was very moving. Kenny won 4 Stanley Cups. But it all traces back to your family. And I was fortunate to have a great family. And I think, you know, you try to do that for my own kids, my own grandkids, to let them understand what it's like to have a loving, caring family that support you in what you do. And it wasn't about money, because we never had any money. It was about just, you know, parents doing what they could, because that was something you wanted to do and they supported you in it. I remember I did an interview after the Olympics, and we were sitting in the kitchen table at my house, and my mother was sitting there, and the reporter was for the Digest magazine, Boston magazine. And he said, "You must be very proud of your son." And my mother didn't bat an eye, and she went, "I'm proud of all my children." And I thought that was a great answer. You know, my brother went to Holy Cross College and got 11 varsity letters. He was a really good athlete. He's an athletic director. He's been very successful in what he does. My 4 sisters, one has since passed, but my mother supported them in what they did. They weren't into sports. Sports weren't around in those days. But anything that they wanted, we found a way, as my mom said, we'll find a way to make ends meet.
Yeah.
And when you think of that, when, you know, I think of that often when I look at this beautiful house I live in. You know, I got a beautiful backyard. I used to play in this yard, in this house as a kid. You know, I have a swimming pool. We never had a swimming pool. You know, so there's all these things that, you know, perks and benefits that you look at and think, wow, this is pretty amazing. And then, like I said, when I go out in the backyard and I look up to the left, I see my aunt and uncle. I can picture Uncle Tony on the porch waving to us because we were playing in the backyard. That's a great life to live. That's a great environment. I thought everybody lived in a 3-family. I didn't know people had their own houses.
What a great answer. Mike, let's conclude this. I'll segue into my final question, which I've been fortunate enough to ask a lot of well-known people in golf and outside of golf. And the responses have been most interesting. And the question is simple. With whom would you play a kind of a dream round of golf? Who would be 3 people, whether living or deceased, who you would say, God, I'd love to play with those 3, and here's where we would go to play. Who would be the 3, and where would you go?
I would obviously say the good Lord. Jesus Christ would be great to play with, and I'm not a super religious person at all, but that would be incredible. Arnold Palmer, and I got to know Mr. Palmer because I played Bay Hill quite a bit. He wasn't playing golf anymore at the time. But it would have been fun to play with him. And I always say my good friend Mario Lemieux. I love playing golf with Mario. We have a lot of fun playing together. And over the years, I played with a lot of great celebrities. The course I would like to play, you know, I played Augusta a few times. I love Old Head over in Ireland.
Sure.
Last year, I got a chance to play Adair Manor.
Yeah, also in Ireland.
I was blown away how nice Adair Manor was, and I only played it that one day. And I think the next Ryder Cup is at Adair Manor.
That's correct. Next fall of 26, 27, rather.
Yeah. I couldn't believe how gorgeous it was with the castle right on the property and how nice it was. So if I could play with those three guys at a damn manor, it would be pretty cool.
How did you form such a strong relationship with Mario Lemieux?
Just from golf tournaments. I got to know him really well when he was still playing. Played in his event many, many, many times over the years. Had a hell of a lot of fun playing with him. A lot of great golf stories. Last year, we went to Sea Island, Georgia for his event, which was spectacular. The year before, I think it was at Whistling Straits. Not Whistling Straits. Arbortown down in that area. That was great. Next year, we don't know where. There was some talk that next year he may try to get us all on Augusta, which is, you know, as you well know, special. But there were so many great golf courses out there. The reason I choose Adair Manor is because that's one you don't really get a chance to play. You know, I can always go to Pebble Beach and Spanish Bay, and I've played Medina, a bunch of the courses in Chicago. I love my course in Jupiter at Trump Course.
Absolutely.
There's so many great golf courses out there. So I try to pick one that's rare to get on and to play.
Hey, I forgot one final question. This is the final question.
Go ahead.
We've got the Olympics coming up, and I do want to look ahead, Mike. You've been fabulous in reminiscing. You've got, obviously, the women started off with, I believe, games start in just a couple of days. We're recording this on Tuesday, February 3rd. I think their first game is the 5th, and then the men start about a week later. What are your thoughts on the women's side? U.S. and Canada have been so strong in the women's game, and then the men's tournament once that begins.
Well, the women's game, they're so good. I talk about this all the time. The women hockey players today, it's amazing, the talent and skill level of the players. The hard part for the women is I think the best two teams in the world are the United States and Canada. And the next two best teams are the girls that didn't make the U.S. team or the Canada team. The depth is so long, so hard, and so good. I know the U.S. has had very good success against the Canadians this year. In their games that they played against each other, I think the U.S. has pretty much controlled it. But that has been like that in the past, and Canada has found a way to win the gold medal. So I think the women will be a favorite going in. And with respect to a lot of the Canadian players, I love Canada, but obviously rooting for the U.S. And I think this is the best men's team we've ever put on the ice. I watched the Four Nations tournament. I was the honorary captain of that team. I got to know a lot of the players. As a matter of fact, there's, I think, 5 Boston University players playing. The big Boston University staff. Mike Sullivan's a head coach, and I think 2 of his assistants are BU guys. Billy Guerin's a general manager. Even though he's a BC guy, I tell him he's one of the BC guys that I really like because of the BU BC. But Canada's loaded. And you got Connor McDavid, Cam McCarr. I still think our depth is better. I think our goaltending is better, although I thought that at the Four Nations in Bennington, the goalie was absolutely sensational. And then you worry about Sweden and Finland. You know, the Soviets aren't going to be there. And the skill level, again, the European players are a lot better now than they were 4 years ago. But I keep telling it, this is the year we're going to take the gold home. And as I told the players, win a gold medal and people will leave our team alone. It's over. It's ended. There's a new group of heroes. So there's a new group of players that my grandkids can look up to. And I told the team when I talked to them, this is their time. You know, what we did in 1980s, what we did, it's not going to change what we did. You know, our moment's going to always be what it is, but it's time for them to have their moment. And I'm hoping that this is the opportunity because I know, like I said, a lot of them, they're great kids, great players. And I'd love to see it happen this time.
Well, your time is forever enshrined in our memories. And, Mike, can't thank you enough for this. And you're right. As an American myself, I'm rooting for the guys to get it done. The Canadians are loaded, but it's gonna be hockey at such a high level. As you said, with the women, there's just not enough depth there. Boy, oh boy, on the men's side, you've got a number of teams that are really good.
Yes, I'm excited about it. It's the best hockey players in the world playing against each other, and I'm curious to see what's going to happen. But you know, I'm always rooting for our team, and hope it's their time.
Captain, thank you so much, Mike Ruzioni. It has been a pleasure having you on Musings on Golf.
Thank you, and we'll have to see each other on a golf course.
Yes, sir.
America, this is your moment. Liam and Harry's limited edition spirit shoe is here so every fan can feel like part of Team USA from the first tee to the final putt. Two head-turning designs, premium deerskin, 100% waterproof with spikeless grip and all-day comfort. Limited run, don't sit this one out. Pre-buy now at williamandharry.com. Get into spirit. Get into comfort.
Titleist Pro V1 and Pro V1X are the best performing, most consistent in the game. So how does the best get better? You start by listening to the best players in the world. You experiment, iterate, validate. You trust the best process to create the best golf ball the game has ever known. The all-new Pro V1 and Pro V1X. More speed off the tee, more control with your irons, more spin with the wedges, and more opportunity to shoot your lowest scores.
Golf is more than your scorecard, the brand of clubs you play, or the clothes you wear. Golf is a journey where every round is a memory, filled with friends old and new. The Friars Golf Club is where those lifelong friendships are made, on the first tee, in the 19th hole, and far beyond. Exclusive trips, unforgettable rounds, and the very best people. Indeed, great courses are simply better with great company. So join the Friars today. To learn more, email us at info@thefriars.com and put the word musings in the subject line to receive a $500 trip credit when you join. So we invite you to stop dreaming and start living the ultimate golf experience at the Friars Golf Club. I'm not sure you can come away from that interview feeling anything but total respect and admiration for Mike Ruzioni, person, in addition to what he accomplished coming up on 46 years ago on a sheet of ice in Lake Placid, New York. Wonderful guy. And I look at him from a sports standpoint. He's my generation, certainly. He's an American hero. And just the way he continues to conduct himself, so thankful to have Mike join us. He will be going to the Olympics on behalf of Delta Airlines, he told us later. And we must wish Mike safe travels. And I know that he'll be rooting on the U.S. squad. That's going to be a heck of a tournament, by the way. As he said, whew, the Canadians are loaded on the men's side. The U.S. team is really, really good. And on the women's side, it's almost a foregone conclusion that you'll see the men, the Canadians and the Americans play for the gold medal. A guy who is on fire right now is Justin Rose. Second win in six starts, his 13th PGA Tour victory at the Farmers Insurance Open. He won the event in 2019. In 2022, you know, the backstory on Rose is he made a decision. He was offered some pretty good money to leave the PGA Tour and the DP World Tour and go play LIV Golf. And a lot of his fellow Ryder Cuppers on the European side did. He did not. Not only did he make the commitment to really rediscover and re-energize himself for the PGA Tour, he rededicated himself to the PGA Tour. Almost won the Masters, obviously, last year with Rory coming so close. He's now number three in the official world golf rankings. If you look at his 13 wins on the PGA Tour, he's won at Muirfield Village, Aronimink, where the PGA Championship will be played this year, Marion, where he won his only major championship in the U.S. Open, Congressional, Pebble Beach, and Colonial. All of those venues have either hosted major golf championships or hosted a Ryder Cup. So this is a guy, one of the great ball strikers of our generation, and a guy who plays the great golf course as well. At age 45, for him, it's clearly just a number, and he has his sights set on the Masters. He, as I said, was so close last year, and his play going wire to wire with the victory at Torrey Pines. You'll hear from this clip, he finished one shot ahead of a record that had long been held by Tiger Woods and by George Burns. And that's what his focus was very clearly down the stretch.
I was keenly aware of it, actually. It was the only thing I was really focused on the last three holes. I wasn't exactly running the ball at the hole, you know, the last couple greens. They were kind of tricky downhillers. I know the line on those putts. So, you know, yeah, I was trying to get in the clubhouse at 23 or better. I was frustrated that I had to lay up. But at the same time, it was like, you know, I have a job to do, you know, leading by seven. It'd be nice to finish with a bit of a flourish and hit something on the green. But I was like, you know what? There's still a bit of a job to do here. So I was trying to stay disciplined. Yeah.
And disciplined he stayed. And that's the type of player that Justin Rose is. Just watch the way he approaches every shot and the everything he goes through, the setup, all of his preparation for hitting a golf shot. Every time it's the same. Repeat, repeat, repeat. And this guy is right now. He will not be playing this week, by the way, at the WM Phoenix Open. Scottie Scheffler returns, having won just a couple of weeks ago at the American Express. Someone who will be joining Scottie Scheffler this week is Brooks Koepka. I can't totally figure out Brooks Koepka, by the way. So the Brooks Koepka we saw is Mr. Nice Guy. We saw him over the four rounds at the Farmers, and that's great. He was nervous going into the event, was high-fiving and slapping kids' hands and so forth. I think that's great. A far cry from the very distant and removed Brooks Koepka that he kind of, you know, he made himself famous for a long time on the PGA Tour. We'll see if he can maybe find some middle ground and continue to be a, you know, someone who can be relatable and also be a big-time winner on the PGA Tour. It's going to be fun to see him. As he said, he thrives on chaos, and there's no more chaotic scene than the 4 days of the WM Phoenix Open. I mentioned Thomas Dietrich earlier, and the LIV Golf finally has received their official World Golf Rankings points. They've gone to 72 holes, starting with the event this week. And again, as I've said before, we'll see. We'll see what all of this means. I, for the life of me, can't imagine that they'll be attracting any PGA Tour players to leave to go to play LIV Golf. And again, a lot of it, I think, comes down to Bryson DeChambeau. He has one more year left on his contract. If he were to leave LIV Golf, I think that would be a massive, massive loss, the likes of which they may not be able to recover. We thank, again, Mike Ruzioni. It was just terrific. Thank you all for listening. Enjoy the Olympics. Enjoy the WM Phoenix Open. Things will get a little bit crazy there, and things will get a lot of fun over in Milan, Italy, as the Winter Games get underway, as we close up with another episode of Musings on Golf.